KUT and KUTX listeners, the stream you've connected to is going silent on April 20th. You're likely using an old bookmark, app, or link that's been around a long time. Please visit kut.org/streams. That's kut.org/streams for more information. If you're still hearing this message next time you listen, there's a form at the bottom of that page that you can fill in for help. Our websites, apps, and npr.org are updated, so you can tune in there. Thank you for listening and supporting our stations.
This is KUT
Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of June 2017. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. An Austin couple declared innocent of sexually abusing a child in a case that grew out of the satanic panic of the 1980s.
It's a really wild, wild story. Rituals involving the dismemberment of babies.
Why, it's not so easy for the city of Austin to regulate amplified sound in the live music capital.
So soundproofing as a whole, that idea and concept is more or less a misnomer.
And a taste of one of the new restaurants popping up on Burnett Road.
He described it as a French bistro meets Waffle House, if you can imagine that.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, if you have not done so already, I would like to let you know you can subscribe to this podcast. If you wish to do so in the iTunes Store, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, we have an RSS feed too. If you prefer that, you can find links to all of those at weekend.kut.org. If you have any questions, email me, nathan@kut.org. If you have any comments, you can email me too. Or you can follow me on Twitter. You can ask me anything on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. So, big news this week in a lurid criminal case going back to the early 1990s. A Texas judge approved the Travis County District Attorney's declaration of innocence for the former owners of a daycare in the Oak Hill neighborhood of Austin. Dan and Fran Keller were imprisoned for 21 years for child abuse. There were claims of satanic rituals involved. They were convicted in 1992 of sexually assaulting a 3-year-old child who was in their care. The Kellers were freed in 2013 after the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals found that a doctor was mistaken in determining that there was any physical evidence of assault. The appeals court back then ruled that the doctor's testimony during the Kellers' trial was false. The physician himself had recanted. Jordan Smith is an investigative reporter. She now works for The Intercept. But when she was at the Austin Chronicle, she covered this story for years. In fact, her reporting certainly played a role, if not the central role, in the Kellers being released from jail. So we reached Jordan on the phone, and she explained how the conviction of the Kellers came amid a kind of national mass hysteria that started in the 1980s, a satanic panic, some called it, that daycares had been overrun by Satanists who wanted to molest, abuse, and brainwash children.
It sounds ridiculous now, but there were hundreds of daycare workers across the country accused and convicted based on really wild accusations of young children who were coached and pressured into saying that things had happened that had never happened. Unfortunately, Austin was not immune, and that happened in 1991 here when a young girl who was in very infrequent drop-in at the Keller's home-based daycare out near the Y basically accused them first only of spanking her, but under intense and repeated questioning from her mother and from a therapist. That story quickly morphed to really disturbing allegations of sexual abuse, and then beyond that, into really wild, wild stories of rituals involving the dismemberment of babies and people being buried in cemeteries and of children being flown to Mexico during the day to be assaulted by Mexican military officials. And it just kind of was a juggernaut that got out of control. I think the real failing here is essentially, with very notable exceptions, the law enforcement officials in this city, and this is both police and prosecutors, absolutely failed the residents of this city, absolutely failed the Kellers by refusing to put on their sort of big boy hats, look at this skeptically, and to see that truth was what came out of this and that justice is what came out of this. I cannot overstate how credulous the investigators were. They believed even the wildest and most improbable stories that were coming out of these children and their parents. And so it just basically, I mean, it really was a witch hunt. It's an actual proper use of the term. And so the Kellers were convicted and sentenced each to 48 years in prison. At the time, Fran was 58 and Dan was 68. So that is a life sentence. And they sat there for about, 16 years. And then I kind of picked up the case in 2008 and decided that it should be reinvestigated because, frankly, the investigation to begin with was terrible. And in so doing, basically re-interviewed a whole bunch of people and found out that there was a young ER doctor at Breckenridge who had examined the little girl who basically made the original outcry here and said that he saw some damage to her genitalia that could be consistent with sexual abuse. What he told me in 2009, however, was that he was wrong and that he knew he was wrong, that shortly after the Kellers were convicted, that he went to a medical conference where he realized that what he had seen on this little girl was actually just a completely normal variant of what female genitalia looks like. That is significant because he's a medical professional, and under the state's, sort of groundbreaking junk science law, the fact that he had changed his medical opinion offered them a way back into court to challenge their conviction. And ultimately, they were successful because there is nobody, the medical science to date is such that it would tell you that what he saw was not abuse. It was absolutely normal. And one disturbing element, of course, is that not long after he found this out, after the Kellers were convicted, he went back to the APD and he said, look, I think I was wrong. And the cops basically just, sort of brushed him off. So, there's a lot of failures here. And if it weren't for people like Dr. Michael Mao, if it weren't for the doctor coming forward and being honest that he had made a mistake, the Kellers would die in prison. And that's profoundly unjust. No crime, I cannot overemphasize the fact that no crime ever happened here. So these are people who were sent to prison for life, essentially, when no crime even happened. It's an absolute travesty. And so it's really, really fantastic that under this new DA administration, that they have really looked at this critically and have understood that nothing ever happened and that this couple is actually innocent. And I'm just thrilled.
Journalist Jordan Smith. Now, we also spoke to the Travis County District Attorney, Margaret Moore, about this. She's been in office only since January.
The Keller case, when I took office, was a matter that had not yet been resolved. The Kellers were released from prison on an appeal bond. So the case was still pending in the District Attorney's office. A decision had been reached even before I got here that there was not enough evidence to retry the case. So the case had to be dismissed by the state. However, the defendant's attorneys had asked the state's attorney to consider dismissing on grounds that are set forth in the Tim Cole Act. And if those grounds were asserted by the state's attorney, then the Kellers would be entitled to relief under the Tim Cole Act, which grants compensation to people who have been convicted and been released on a writ of habeas corpus for whom there's not sufficient evidence remaining in the case.
How much compensation might the Kellers be eligible for under the provisions of this act?
As I understand it, they're entitled to $80,000 a year for the years they were incarcerated. It's 21 years.
What was the basis of your decision? I mean, I know that you personally reviewed the court transcripts in this case, right?
Yes. I myself read the entire transcript, looked at the videos that were introduced in the trial, read the transcript of the post-conviction writ hearing, and so that I personally looked at the doctor's recanted testimony and his new testimony. And then I spent a good bit of time studying the law on this. The term actual innocence is one that has evolved through the years. So I looked at the current state of the law and the current state of the evidence and made a personal determination, as required by the statute, that there was not sufficient evidence remaining after you removed the recanted testimony upon which a reasonable juror could vote to convict.
Taking a giant step back here, I mean, to the casual observer, this seems like it was a gross miscarriage of justice. Would you agree with that?
You know, that is not a term that I would... I did not look at it that way. I had a legal analysis to make. I had to look at the evidence as it stands today. I had to look at the transcript that of what was presented to the jury that voted to convict. And, you know, I didn't take it upon myself to go back into the minds of those that were trying the case back then and assess whether or not they it was an appropriate prosecution. To me, I had a job to do as of now, and that's the job I did.
District Attorney Moore, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you for talking to me about this.
You're most welcome, Nathan. Have a good day.
The City of Austin is in the process of adopting several plans that will guide the future of development and transportation throughout the region. This week, the city revealed a new guide for the future of street design. KUT's Saida Hassan explains that.
The new guide takes into account some key considerations to help make Austin's streets more uniform and consistent. That includes the community surrounding a street, the number of lanes, and planning for different modes of transportation, like bikes and public transit. Anique Baudet is with the Austin Transportation Department.
Why are we doing this? Well, we have safety issues. We have traffic congestion that calls for more travel choices to help ameliorate those issues that we're having with transportation.
The guide would update Austin's existing transportation plan, which has been in place for more than 20 years. City staff say that plan was designed with cars in mind and doesn't reflect changing transportation needs. The new one divides each street into three sections: pedestrian zones, bicycle zones, and motor vehicle and transit zones. It also categorizes streets by their context, like urban, suburban, or industrial. Leanne Miller is a project coordinator with the transportation department. She says features like sidewalks and bike lanes may be ramped up or scaled down depending on the street function.
Many of our streets, like a Lamar, for example, traverses many different places and should be context sensitive and reflect the context of those places and may look different in different parts of town.
The guide lays out a series of combinations called cross sections, illustrating how streets could look in different parts of the city. Miller says those options have been scaled back from the existing transportation guide.
It's a little bit confusing for designers, engineers, planners to figure out what might be the best cross section for a given street. So we kind of want to simplify that a little bit.
Tuesday's unveiling of the guide was well attended by city staff and private sector developers. Some raised questions of how a uniform street guide would work in a city that's still starkly divided along economic lines. One developer noted that people who work lower paying jobs in the central city typically have to live further out, and they have little choice but to drive into Austin. Anique Baudet with the transportation department says it's clear there's still a need for people to drive, but the goal is to make Austin a little less auto-centric and better designed for transit. Comments on the guide will be accepted through the end of this year on the Austin Transportation Department's website. Saida Hassan, KUT News.
A recent lawsuit by a brand new Austin hotel against an established music venue for being too loud identified for a lot of people a growing problem, not just downtown, but throughout the city as well. That's why music industry representatives, city staff, business owners, they've all been negotiating rules to try and smooth the relationship between existing music venues and new businesses that are built nearby. An early version of the city's proposed rules says new businesses would need to make a commitment to build in a way that accommodates nearby sound. But what might they actually be committing to? What is sound mitigation? KUT's Audrey McGlinchey went in search of a demonstration.
First off, don't call it soundproofing.
So soundproofing as a whole, that idea and concept is more or less a misnomer.
Josh Ball owns Room Mute, a company that does sound mitigation for restaurants, bars, and music venues. He's the guy who makes it possible for you to have a conversation with a friend over dinner at a restaurant without picking up what the table next to you is saying. Ball says it's really hard to insulate a room entirely from outside noise.
You can make something pretty much dampened, but the cost of it is so high that it's infeasible for a space to do that.
So Ball and his buddy Patrick Hirschfeld agreed to show me what you can do. We met up at Hirschfeld's studio in far southwest Austin. He's converted a ranch-style home into a studio. There, the guys positioned a mic 8 feet from a speaker. Think of the mic as a hotel or a restaurant, and the speaker, an outdoor music venue. Tonight's show, Tom Petty. People come, people go, some grow young, some this is how you don't know how it feels might sound if you were in the audience at a show. Then Ball and Hirschfeld grab some high-density insulation panels. They set them up in a V-shape around the speaker. The sound comes through much lower, but we're not always dealing with just insulation. A new business going up alongside a music venue will most likely have windows. So Ball and Hirschfeld move the speaker onto a stool on the grass, just outside a double-paned window. Ball explains how that window can mitigate sound.
As the sound travels from the speaker, it goes into the glass. It takes some energy to go through that glass, and then it goes through a void, which is with a sealed gas inside of it to actually keep oxygen out of it, and then a second pane of glass. So every transition that it makes, it takes more energy, which is a further reduction in volume.
So let's hear it. Remember, here's our clear sound. And here's the sound through the double-paned window with gas. Much, much quieter, but still perhaps enough to keep you awake. It's unclear exactly when council will vote on a change to rules for music venues and new businesses. A vote scheduled for this month was delayed. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
Governor Greg Abbott signed a bill last week that would increase postpartum depression screenings for low-income women in Texas. State estimates say about 200,000 mothers in Texas will be eligible for screening each year. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports that this bill is part of an effort to deal with the rise of maternal mortality in Texas.
Almost 7 years ago, Donna Kreuzer was taking care of her newborn granddaughter in a hotel room in San Antonio. Her daughter, Christy, was attending a law conference with her husband, and Kreuzer came along to help out. She says during that trip, her daughter revealed a secret she had been keeping for 8 weeks.
She came through the hotel door, and a mama always knows. The look on her child's face was telling me, something's deathly wrong here. And she came forthright telling both her husband and I that she had been suffering with postpartum depression since day 3 of our grandbaby's life.
This was something that Kreuzer had been prepared for. Christy had a history with depression and was at risk for postpartum depression. It's one of the most common complications following a pregnancy. In fact, this affects about 1 in 6 new mothers in Texas. Kreuzer says the family jumped into gear. They got Christy a psychiatrist, a therapist. She went back to a counselor she had worked with before.
She had the support and love and the resources from her husband and I and our families and her friends. So it was immediately that we stepped in.
But even with the help, in 2010, Christy took her own life. She was 36.
I'm sort of the belief now, although I don't know that I will ever know the true reason, but I have to think that the delay in intervention was playing a major part in her inability to recover.
Kreuzer has spent the following years as an advocate for increased screening for postpartum depression, as well as increased access to mental health care for women who need it. And during the recently ended Texas legislative session, she supported House Bill 2466. Once it becomes law in September, mothers covered by Medicaid or CHIP will be screened for postpartum depression when they take their babies to a well-check appointment.
Anything to help more women be seen by a doctor and try to identify any problems early is vital.
That's Maggie Jo Buchanan with a group called Young Invincibles. She says this is a great step, but the state can't just stop at improving screening.
There's still going to be an extremely strong need to expand access to treatment.
Buchanan says women on Medicaid are kicked out of the program 2 months after giving birth. And since Texas lawmakers did not expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, many low-income women face having no insurance after that 2 months window. Both Buchanan and Donna Kreuzer say this new law to increase diagnosis is a step in the right direction, but it's also important to make sure women can get the help they need. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
In the Austin Independent School District, about 60% of the students qualify for free and reduced lunch to be served to them in the school, low-income students. And when the summer arrives, a lot of those kids can go hungry. But schools and parks in Austin are trying to keep students fed over the summer by serving free meals for children under the age of 18. KUT's Kate Gretzinger reports.
180 children gathered in the cafeteria at Harris Elementary School Tuesday morning. They're particularly excited about one item on their lunch trays.
The chicken nuggets.
It's tasty.
The milk.
Chicken nuggets.
The children are at the school as part of a free summer camp put on by the Andy Roddick Foundation. It runs Monday through Friday for 6 weeks, and each day the kids get a free breakfast and lunch. AISD cooks and serves the meals, just like they do during the school year, but every kid eating at Harris Elementary, or the more than 100 sites that are serving food around Austin this summer, eats for free. Derek Lambert is the program manager of No Kid Hungry, a national nonprofit that is helping spread the word about the free summer lunch program.
When a child comes through the door to eat a meal, they don't have to provide their name, they don't have to, their parents don't have to provide income information.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Central Texas Food Bank are helping to fund the summer program. The USDA picks meal sites based on how many children eligible for free and reduced lunch live nearby. But only a fraction of those kids in Austin are taking advantage of the program. Organizers think that's simply because parents don't know the programs exist. No Kid Hungry's Derek Lambert hopes to change that with a new tool to spread the word.
You can text food to 877-877. Families and caregivers can find out when and where meals are being served nearby. This service also operates in Spanish. You can text comida to 877-877, and the prompt comes back in Spanish and gives the same information.
So far this summer, it looks like it's working.
We've really seen a huge uptick in usage of the service this year. We've actually seen more use of the service since things got started this summer than in all previous years combined.
You can find a full list of free summer lunch sites online at the Texas Department of Agriculture's website, or just do as Lambert said and text food to 877-877. Kate Gretzinger, KUT News.
Fish. They can breathe underwater. They're great swimmers, but they're not really well known for their singing. But they do sing, kind of. KUT's Mose Bushell tells us about scientists on the Gulf Coast hoping that that fact can help sustain fish populations.
Can you do an imitation of the sound?
Oh, I could try.
This is Brad Arisman. He's assistant professor of fisheries ecology at UT Austin. The sound he's about to make is that of a male corvina fish.
It's going to be horrible, but basically it's kind of sounds like static, but very noisy static. So it's just kind of...
Okay, here's the real sound.
So what the sound that you're hearing is of simultaneous croaking of, in some cases, up to a million or more male Gulf corvina.
Every year, as part of their mating ritual, the male corvina crowd a single estuary in the Gulf of California and start this croaky chorus. Fishermen can even hear it in their boats.
And it's so loud that actually it makes it difficult for fishermen or anyone on the boats to actually have a conversation.
But it makes it really easy to catch the fish in big nets. That can lead to overfishing, so fisheries managers set limits. Timothy Rowell is a student of Arisman's. He studies at Scripps Oceanographic Institute.
Not only are managers worried, but fishermen are worried, and researchers like us are worried because we're not sure whether they're setting the limits at a sustainable level.
The challenge for Arisman and Rowell was to figure out how many corvina there are to make sure they're not being overfished. The answer, use the fish's sound to take the census. Arisman says they put microphones in the water to record the corvina.
And then simultaneously, we were recording with the sonar how many fish are in the water.
To see if the two things correlate.
Because if they correlate, that means you should be able to use sound to estimate how many fish are present.
And it worked.
Yeah, it worked.
That's Timothy Rowell again. He says the success of the study means someday fisheries could be monitored year-round by keeping microphones in the water. Arisman and Rowell are now in Port Aransas, Texas, to find out if the same approach can be used to monitor sea trout there. That research has just started. Do you do a good imitation of a sea trout?
I'm not the sea trout, man. I could do a Gulf corvina, but I'm not going to do the sea trout.
So here's a recording. Sounds a little like the corvina. Mose Bouchel, KT News.
Burnett Road in North Austin has been seeing quite a lot of growth over the past couple years, including a lot of increased restaurant activity. And this spring, Burnett Road got a new player with the name you might find familiar. Longtime Uchi veteran Philip Spear and his partner opened a French-inspired place called Bon Ami. And here to talk about that is Austin-American statesman restaurant critic Matthew Odom. Hello, Matthew.
Hey there, Nathan.
So what kind of French place is this?
Well, when I talked to Chef Spear when the restaurant was opening, he described it as a French bistro meets Waffle House, if you can imagine that.
Waffle House. So they got like hash browns and all that kind of thing?
Well, some people might know of the smothered and covered hash browns.
Absolutely.
At Waffle House. It's different here. They're called pomme rosti. Am I saying that properly?
Yeah, pomme rosti, I guess. Yeah.
There you go. So what they do is they take two different types of potatoes. They wash a lot of starch out of them, and they shred them up and weave them into this kind of a bird's nest that they then freeze and then they fry to order. So they're kind of like fancy hash browns, I guess you could say. What's really fancy is the toppings. You'll have something like bacon and a soft scramble with house-made Boursin cheese, which is a really nice breakfast play. They do a take on lox and bagel with smoked salmon and dill, caper and tomato, and that kind of thing. And then they do some really decadent, over-the-top stuff. They have one that has this great seared wobble of foie gras with a cognac gravy and a soft egg. And if that's not enough, there's one that has dollops of creme fraiche dotted with caviar, actually.
Ooh. What about lunch and dinner? How does that play out in terms of the French influence?
A lot of the dishes that you see at lunch, you'll see at dinner also. There's a few more entrees at dinner. But we're talking things like the platonic ideal of French onion soup, just kind of the sweet caramelized onions and the melting cheese there on top. They do an awesome crispy octopus salad. I think it's flash fried there at the end with some rice flour or something. So it's kind of dusty and crunchy. It's tender. I'm sure it's sous vide before it's fried. They actually do some crossover dishes like a French dip croissant. So it's this buttery French croissant, but it's stuffed with brisket and served with a side of pho broth. So that's kind of a dish that touches France and Texas and Vietnam. And then other bistro classics are a perfect roasted chicken, a shrimp dish that was really nice. They also do a Parisian-style gnocchi, which is not going to be the big heavy potato style, but kind of lighter, fluffier ones that are just washed with a little bit of brown butter and dusted with some Parmesan. But it's not all French influence. You can also get one of the best cheeseburgers in town. I think it's 50% sirloin, 50% brisket. It's served on a milk bun, and as some people might know, Spear was a multiple James Beard semi-finalist for Best Pastry Chef in America when he was at Uchi.
And I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, because there must be something going on with their dessert menu. Because
there is.
Of that.
And there's also, there's kind of, if you want to see it this way, a nod to Uchi with probably their lightest dish, might have been my favorite, a raw salmon with cantaloupe and a tomato granita on top of it. So a nice, light, refreshing summer dish. But yeah, the desserts, of course, Philip Spear is going to do some good desserts. He has fun with a banana split profiterole, which are, you know, little dainty profiteroles served on top of...
What are profiteroles?
You know, little French puff pastries, and there's vanilla ice cream, and they're served on top of caramelized bananas. Mm. He also does a really decadent chocolate devil's food cake with a nice light milk sherbet.
Was there anything that you didn't like about Bonhomie?
You know, this sparse kind of decor kind of took a little bit of getting used to, but once you realize, you see the stacked plates, you see the hanging warming lights, you see the kind of splashes of red on the booths, you kind of do get that diner feel to it. And I think part of that stripped away aesthetic really allows the food to shine. Maybe the croque monsieur could have had some more ham in it. And if my server never said the word roughage again, it would be too soon. So besides those few quibbles, not much to argue about.
So it sounds like it's not like some super fancy place. What are the prices like?
Right. So those pomme roasty, they run anywhere from $10 to $20. I think the one with caviar is like $24. But in general, you're looking at entrees in the lower teens. I mean, what if I told you that one of the best new restaurants in Austin only had two dishes on it that were in the 20s?
That would be a little surprising.
That would be a little surprising.
So you're going to get in and out of there for $20, $25?
You might get out. It depends on whether it's lunch or dinner, but you could get out of there for $20 at lunch, $30 at dinner. You know, of course, it depends on if you have a glass of wine and if you have your own dessert or if you want to share.
Sure. All right. Well, the restaurant is Bonhomie, and it's located on Burnett Road, about halfway between Hancock and Koenig Lane. And you can read Matthew Odom's full review right now at Austin360.com or in Friday's print edition of the Austin American Statesman. Matthew Odom, good to talk to you.
Always a pleasure, Nathan.
That is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of June 2017. Thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Tell your friends and family about us. And if you have any questions or comments, email me, nathan@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Really do appreciate you listening to this. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and kut.org. And then,